This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. West Side Story, The Sound of Music, The Curse of the Cat People, The Body Snatcher, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Somebody Up There Likes Me, I Want to Live, The Setup, The Andromeda Strain, Odds Against Tomorrow, and Star Trek The Motion Picture were all directed by Robert Wise. And before he made those films, he won an Academy Award for editing Citizen Kane. The Mill Valley Film Festival, which is now underway in California, is paying tribute to Wise. Tomorrow night, the tribute continues with an outdoor screening of The Sound of Music in the amphitheater at the top of Mount Tamalpais. Next week, the festival will present a retrospective of Wise's films. I spoke with Robert Wise in 1989, after the release of his movie Rooftops. I asked him first about the challenge of adapting the stage musical West Side Story into a movie. In a naturalistic movie, it can look very artificial when street gangs start singing Leonard Bernstein songs and doing dances choreographed by Jerome Robbins.
Well, that was the biggest problem we faced from the beginning, and this is something that Jerry Robbins and I struggled with the most in putting on the film. You see, the stage, as you point out, the stage is not real. You're once removed from reality. You have the proscenium arch there. You're not into reality, so people can go out of dialogue into dance or out of dialogue into song without a little sense of embarrassment. Film is a very, very real medium, and it doesn't take kindly to stylization, unless it's another fantasy like, let's say, Wizard of Oz. So we struggled with that the most. I was the one that insisted that we open West Side Story on the actual streets of New York. There was no way we were going to be able to get a stylized set such as they had on the stage to work in films. And Jerry was all for it. He said, Bob, I agree with you completely, but you've given me the biggest challenge in the whole picture to put my most stylized dancing, which is in that opening, against the most real backgrounds that we'll have. So we struggled with it. One of the reasons I came up with that helicopter opening was to give people a look at New York, a real New York, but a look they hadn't seen before, a kind of an abstract look at New York, although it was real, to help put them in the mood to accept these kids down the line a little bit dancing in the streets.
And the helicopter opening you're talking about is a long aerial shot of Manhattan, and then it kind of zooms down into where the gang members are.
Right. And then Jerry did something else there, too, that when he got the kids out on the street after they went through the playground, if people recall that, they had the jets walking along, and they didn't just go into a dance. One of the kids kind of swings his arm in sort of a dance movement, and they walk along a couple more steps, and two of the guys do it, and then we got a few more steps, and then three of them do it, and before you know it, he had segued very slowly into dance on the street, and that helped very much ease us into it without that sense of embarrassment.
I'll preface this question by telling you that I love the movie and I love the choreography, but I was wondering if you ever thought, and Jerome Robbins ever thought, that people would almost make fun of the film because these tough macho gang members are breaking into really balletic choreography. I mean, it's modern dance, it's not ballet, but there's some very balletic moves in it.
Right. No, we didn't think so. It had worked wonderfully well on the stage. Nobody took any question of that, didn't take it apart. And, of course, Jerry's choreography in the show is also strong and so masculine, you know, we thought it would work. What we had to do was what I was describing to you a while ago was to find ways to make it compatible with the realism of the screen. And I have to feel that the way the film has been received over the years, we were pretty successful in doing that.
Two of the leads in the Puerto Rican gang, George Takaris and Natalie Wood, weren't really Puerto Rican. Was it hard to find real Puerto Rican actors at the time to cast in the film?
Yes, there weren't any really that were right for those parts. We did a very exhausting search for actors, both coasts, both in New York and Los Angeles, and we interviewed and read just literally dozens of people for every role. And it finally ended up with the ones we put on the screen. I think they came off just fine. They, of course, we did have Rita Moreno, who is Puerto Rican, playing Anita, and that worked out fine. But we were going for the best people, and since we couldn't find everybody who was supposed to be Puerto Rican, who qualified as Puerto Ricans, we had to go the other way.
What did you do to make them convincing?
Well, worked with him, and of course George had played. Although George had played other roles on the stage, he worked on his accent, got the accent, and then in his looks, we used the darker makeup and all, and Natalie a little bit of that, and working on the accent, and sort of studying and knowing. Well, we had a lot of friends around. We did have a lot of other kids on the show in the other parts, smaller parts, who were Puerto Rican, and they spent a lot of time together, and I think they were able to pick up the kind of idiosyncratic aspects of the Puerto Rican people. You know?
Can we go go back to your very early career, right after you got out of that shipping room at RKO right. and you started editing.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You edited Orson Welles' film Citizen Kane.
That's right.
How much freedom did you have when you were editing that movie?
I had the same kind of freedom I had with any other director that I was working with in those days. People have questioned me about that, and I thought probably Orson, being the kind of hands-on man that he was, had come to the editing room and told me where to cut. He didn't do that at all. I worked with him, as I said, like with other directors. I would get a sequence, get all the film in a sequence. I'd put it into a first cut the way I liked it, first cut the sequence, my version. I'd show it to Orson then, and he might like parts of it. He might ask for a change here or there to use a two-shot rather than a close-up or put this line in some other angle. Well, the usual process you go through between editor and director. I would make those changes, show it to him again, and that was the way it went all the way through the film. I don't think that he ever came into the editing room one time to impose himself on the actual process of editing. But, of course, he had his input in it after I had made my cuts.
That was a film that broke a lot of conventions. What do you think of as the most unconventional thing that you did in the movie?
Well, I think it was number one. It was an unconventional film to start with. You know, you looked at those delis every day and were kind of dumbfounded at the kind of scenes you were seeing and the compositions you were seeing, the setups, the photography. I think the area that I had the most input in was the breakfast table scene. If people recall that scene that shows a series of very short little interplay pieces, the deterioration of the marriage between Cain and his wife, and the actually, as it now appears in the film, the timing, the rhythm of that whole piece, the speed of the whip pans that we use going from one segment to another, and where the dialogue came in preceding each piece, the whole rhythm of the piece was all developed in the cutting room. It was a brilliant idea, brilliantly shot, but the rhythm and the sense of it as it is on the screen was all developed in the editing room, and I would think that would be the major contribution.
Now, you also edited Orson Welles' film The Magnificent Ambersons. That was a film that the studio took him off of because the film was going so over budget and it was very long, and he was...
Well, that's not quite the story, no.
Okay, go ahead.
No, he wasn't taken off. He was unable to finish. He had finished his shooting on the film, and war had just started when we were still filming it. And Orson was asked shortly after Pearl Harbor Day by our government to go to South America as soon as he finished filming on Ambersons and to make a picture with the Brazilian people, to make a film down there. It was part of a good neighbor policy we had in trying to keep all the countries in South America on our side of the war. So Orson did this. He grabbed at it because he was draft age. He was only about 27 then, didn't want to go in the army, so he left. So he did finish filming the picture before he went down to South America. And then later, after we had it all finished up and had bad problems at previews in which people just didn't sit still for it and laughed at it and all, Orson was unable to come back to the States and to be part of what we did to try to help the film and fix it. He was stuck down in Brazil making this film and just no way he could get back. So he wasn't, as I say, taken off by the company. He was just unable to get back. And then I had to, along with Jack Moss, who was Orson's man on the film back here in L.A., to go ahead and finish it the best way we could to get a picture that the studio felt they could release.
Was there pressure on you from the studio to make cuts that you thought Orson Welles wouldn't have liked?
Not particularly. I don't think there was that kind of tug of war. I'd say Jack Moss was there all the time. Orson had been sent a copy of the film and sent back his thoughts on it. And I, someplace along the line, when I've lost, I had about a 36-page cable from him about suggested ideas and changes, this, that, and the other. And that was even before we'd had our previews. But we all were working for the same end, not to save as much of what Orson had done and the quality of what he had done and still get a film for which the audience would sit still, because literally they were just disastrous previews the first two or three we had.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to cut and we had to add some scenes, bridge scenes and whatnot. And I think the fact that the film has come down through the years as something of a classic in its own right means that we didn't completely vitiate everything that Orson had set out to do with the film.
My guest is film director Robert Wise. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1989 interview with Robert Wise, director of the movies West Side Story, The Sound of Music, I Want to Live, The Setup, Somebody Up There Likes Me, and The Day the Earth Stood Still.
The first film that you directed was Curse of the Cat People. This was in 1944, and it was produced by Val Lewton,
yes,
who also did I Walk with a Zombie and Cat People, The Leopard Man.
Right.
So after you were brought on to finish up that film, You directed The Body Snatcher, which starred Boris Karloff. This was a 1945 movie. And it's a film in which Karloff supplies a teaching doctor with freshly killed bodies for the doctor's anatomy lessons. It's a wonderful film. It's really moody and shadowy. And I was wondering, this might be unanswerable, but how you learned to get that kind of dark, shadowy, scary feeling in a film.
Well, it's part of it. Always starts with a story, and everything starts with that script and that story, and that was the nature of that piece, as well as parts of Curse of the Cat People. And Val Lewton, who was a terribly creative and talented producer, had a real knack for coming up with stories that lent themselves to doing that kind of dark, heavy, mysterious, effective kind of filming and look. These were black and white films, by the way, and that also lends itself, I think, more than even color to that sort of film noir kind of look. And we had excellent cameramen at RKO those days who specialized in kind of low-key effects and low-key lighting. And so we planned and staged and photographed that way. Lewton was very interesting. You see, he was such a contrast in his thinking to today's horror stories, which are so filled with the blood and gore and monsters and things. Lewton didn't deal in that with his films. He always felt that the greatest fear the audience has is the fear of the unknown, such as, did you hear that? Hey, what's that shadow over there? That kind of thing. That could be as scary to audiences and more than the specifics. And so that's why most of the films that Val was involved in had that kind of look and feeling that you could never really be sure what was out there behind that corner in the dark beyond what you could see.
Well, you mentioned shadows. I think the first time you see Boris Karloff, what you're really seeing is a shadow.
That's right. You just see a shadow. It's kind of scary.
Now, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi were in this film. How did they feel about being in horror films for so long? Do you know?
I didn't talk to them too much about that. Boris was very keen about doing The Body Snatcher because if anybody in the audience knows the film, it's really a kind of an acting tour de force for him in his two or three marvelous scenes with Henry Danielle, who plays the doctor. It's a real kind of contest between the two. And Boris was very anxious to do it because he wanted to prove to the people and to the business that he was an actor, not just a person to put in horror films, you know, a monster, that he was not just a monster. So that was what his concentration was on. And Lugosi came in as kind of an afterthought. He wasn't in the original script. The studio decided it would be a very good idea if they could put Lugosi and Karloff on the marquee. So Mr. Lewton, who was a very talented writer as well, added in the part of the porter that Lugosi played. And Lugosi didn't work very long, just a few days, and he was not very well. He was not well at all. I had to kind of nurse him through the part as it was. So I didn't really get into any conversations with him about how they felt, except that I knew that Boris was very anxious to shed that image and show that he could do something beyond just be a monster.
Mm-hmm. You've done so many different kinds of pictures over your career. How did you get to choose the movies? Were you chosen or did you choose most of the time?
Well, most of the scripts that I've done with stories have been the material that has come to me. People come to me and say, I have a script, or I have this property, I have this book. I've come up with a couple of them. I found The Haunting, one of my favorite films, mm-hmm. a ghost story told in the 60s. I came up with The Sand Pebbles. I've worked on a few that haven't gotten on the screen, but most of them are either studio or independent producers or a writer might send me a script and say, hey, this is something I'm trying to get off the ground, and what do you think? Would you like to do it?
Mm-hmm. Is there a kind of movie you feel most at home directing?
I don't have a favorite. I really people have asked me that many times. Do I prefer to do musicals, adventure, drama, love stories? Whatever is the best script. I do have a couple of no-nos. I haven't done any Westerns since the 50s. I found I didn't really enjoy doing Westerns too much, and I thought the scene had been overdone for so many years. I gave that up, and I had one venture into spectacle back in the early 50s doing Helen of Troy, and made that all in Rome, and I found I didn't enjoy that genre of film, so I've avoided that since. But other than that, it happens to just boils down to what is a very good script, what catches me up, and what do I feel is material that will make a very good movie, and something that has another thing, that it's a film, a story that has something to say, some comment to make.
Rescreening some of your early films got me to thinking about how much the use of music in movies has changed over the years. Not only the kind of music that's used, but how it's used to underscore dramatic moments.
Yes, it has changed quite a lot, of course. I think music is advancing, is changing, is used more in underscoring, putting aside the songs and that kind of treatment. I've always felt, at one time there was a kind of thinking in Hollywood, well, what do you need music in that scene for, to give a scene? I have always felt, what can music bring to a scene or a sequence? If it can bring something to it and add an element, a dimension, let's have it. So I know in my films, I'm very much for as much music as will contribute to the scenes that I'm putting up there.
Did you ever feel that you had a scene ruined by bad music or by the wrong music?
No, I don't think so. I think I've had some times when cues have been made, music cues have been made for a scene that I didn't like, and I just dropped it out. I didn't use it. I wouldn't let something go through that I felt was detrimental to a to a scene or a sequence. And occasionally you'll get a piece of music by a composer that it's already scored, and you get it in, and you just don't feel that it helps the sequence, and then you drop it out. But you don't leave it in if it's going to hurt.
Do you remember what the transition was like for you, going from black and white to color?
Yes, I see, my first color picture was kind of an adventure thing called, I think that's the first one, Destination Gobi, all shot up in the Pyramid Lakes of the desert north of Reno. And in those days, of course, we had big, tremendous three-strip cameras, you know. This was before single-strip color came in. They were big, huge, monster things to have to get around on locations, and that was an annoyance. I was fascinated by that prospect of doing something in color and seeing the difference and seeing how it had to be treated. And you found you had to get the different sort of sets of values, not only for the cameraman's lighting, but for the colors of your costumes and your sets and all of that, to get those all working right together, much more so than you did in black and white.
Was the color true? Were you pleased with the kind of color you could get?
Yes, I'm pretty much pleased with it. Of course, the old three-strip was the truest color, I guess, that we've ever had. It's a little truer than the one-strip, a single-strip film. I've always felt, myself, that there's a tendency in films to have the colors be too colorful, too much color in them. And if I have a choice, I like to try to desaturate my colors a little bit in the films, because I think even though they're supposed to be an accurate reflection of what's out there, I think sometimes the whole process, well, to see the whole process of photography picks things up anyway, even in black and white. The blacks are blacker, the highlights are brighter than they are to the naked eye. So I think to counterbalance that in color, you have to, if you want real, true, authentic-looking color in your scenes, you have to desaturize it in the printing some in the lab, not let it go all out.
Since you started as a film editor and then became a director and producer, I'm curious if editing movies affected your approach as a director?
I suppose to a certain extent. You don't do it consciously, but obviously knowing film and knowing what you can do with the film in the cutting room does affect you. Many people have the idea that if you've been a film editor and turned director, that you would shoot much less film because you would know just exactly how you want it to go together. But that's not the case, really, certainly not with me. As a former editor, you know how valuable it is to have good coverage, a lot of coverage down in that cutting room. So later on, after the picture's finished shooting, we could do a lot more if you have a lot of angles. If you take a picture out to a preview and have a bad laugh someplace in the scene, you need to cut a line out. If you have that extra angle up there on the shelf you'd never use, you break it down and cut it in, it allows you to lose the line. There's just so much flexibility in the cutting room that former editors, I think, tend to shoot more film.
You've made so many movies. Do you have any favorites among them?
Not a single one. I don't know whether most directors do or not. I do know Gaz Kazan has. Yeah, I've read something where he said yes very quickly, America, but that was his own story, you know, so it was kind of autobiographical in a sense. I don't have. I've done, this was my 39th film, Rooftops. I have maybe 10 or 12 out of those that I would prefer or like better for one reason or another. You've named a number of them, West Side Story, and Sound of Music, Day of the Earth Stood Still, The Setup, Somebody Up There Likes Me, The Haunting, The Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen, I Want to Live, if I didn't mention that, Andromeda Strain, about a dozen.
Film director Robert Wise recorded in 1989. The Mill Valley Film Festival, which is currently underway in California, is paying tribute to Wise.